Grab your Bibles, if you would, and I want you to open them to 1 Samuel 25. 1 Samuel 25, I want you to hold your place in 1 Samuel 25. But first, let me take you on a little trip back into American history. The date is April 27th, 1777. The place, Ridgefield, Connecticut. 2 years into the American Revolutionary War, and one of George Washington's favorite and most reliable generals was outmanned and outgunned by oncoming British forces. He ordered his men to retreat, and they did. They obeyed their orders, but he alone stayed there on the hill crest. It was one of the bravest things that anybody had ever seen. The commanding officer remained at the battle line by himself, single-handedly fighting off the British so that his men would have those few precious seconds that they needed to escape into the woods. In the process, his horse got shot out from under him and left him pinned partially underneath. But somehow, even from that position, he fought off the British soldiers who were at arm's length, and he managed to escape. This was just one of many heroic feats that the men under his command had seen him pull off. His name was Benedict Arnold, and he was one of America's youngest generals and arguably their most capable military mind. But he had a fragile ego, and the Continental Congress, for reasons that are still unknown to us, overlooked him for promotion time and time again. Almost all of his contemporaries, his friends, men whose skill and accomplishments were vastly inferior to his own, historians say, they got promoted all around him. To make matters worse, Congress refused to raise his salary even when he desperately needed it and clearly deserved it. Let's fast forward now a few months to October 1777, Saratoga, New York. Benedict Arnold is now under the command of General Horatio Gates, a man whose skill would not have held a candle to Arnold's. The men at Saratoga loved and they preferred Benedict Arnold, but General Gates was in charge. General Gates refused to heed Arnold's counsel about how to fight the battle, mainly because he was jealous. And then as an act of petty spite, Gates banished General Arnold to his tent where he was commanded to sit the battle out. But then the battle started to go badly, just like Arnold had predicted that it would, and Arnold couldn't stand it, so he broke out of his tent and he rode up to the front lines like a madman, from where he organized some men and launched a counterattack that shifted the entire momentum of the battle. Historians say that Arnold's bravery and his intervention won the Battle of Saratoga. During that battle, he was wounded. He got shot in the leg, and he had to spend the next 5 months recuperating in a hospital tent. Meanwhile, General Gates took full credit for the victory, never even mentioning Arnold and what he'd done in that battle. Once again, the Continental Congress gave no recognition and no reward to Benedict Arnold. Fast forward now to 1779. Benedict Arnold is in Philadelphia. His wife, Peggy, a Tory loyalist, has been passing him British articles about the war. And General Arnold realizes that the British officers speak better of him, speak with more respect of him than even his own government does. Peggy arranges a meeting between Arnold and British officer John Andre. And just like that, an American patriot war hero becomes a national symbol of cowardice and greed, a man whose name is now synonymous in our culture with the word traitor. How tragic to spend a lifetime faithfully serving one allegiance, only to become a traitor to it in the end. Today in 1 Samuel 25, you're going to see David come this close to doing just that, to selling out the values that he has championed up to this point. Think of 1 Samuel 25 as part two of the story that we looked at last week in 1 Samuel 24. We left off chapter 24 with David as the hero. David bravely defying his men who are urging him to take matters into his own hands and kill Saul. In that moment in chapter 24, David was the one who boldly urged his men to trust God and to wait on God and to do things his way. Now in this chapter, chapter 25, David is the one whose faith falters. David is the one whose flesh gets the best of him, and David has to have somebody else come to his rescue. And y'all, while on one level, this is very understandable, right? We all have our weak moments. It's at least going to leave us wondering. When you get to the end of 1 Samuel 25, it leaves you wondering, is David really the promised king that we've been waiting for? Let's read 1 Samuel 25, verse 1. Now Samuel died. And all Israel assembled to mourn for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. Now, this is really important, I think, because Samuel had always functioned as a type of father figure for David, a spiritual mentor. Samuel was the one who believed in David when nobody else did, and now he's dead. So David, understandably, feels shaken. He feels unmoored. Verse 2, and there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. Simply owning land in that day would have made you wealthy. To have 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats is supposed to sound excessive. It would have put you in the upper 0.01%. Saying a man has 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats would be like saying today that somebody had a fleet of Lamborghinis and a couple of vacation homes in Turks and Caicos. Verse 3, now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife was Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. How many of you ladies feel like this describes your marriage? Okay, just kidding. Don't raise your hand for that. But this really does get interesting here. Let me just summarize the next few verses for you. David and his men have been staying in the vicinity of Nabal and his shepherds and his pastures. And a number of times, David and his men protect Nabal and his property from Philistine raiding parties. They've been very sacrificially helpful to Nabal's shepherds. They really helped Nabal's shepherds thrive this past year. Verse 16 says that David had been like a shield wall for Nabal. Well, in those days, it was customary to one time a year at the time of the sheep shearing to give a thank you gift to people like that who had assisted you throughout the year. So David sent some of his young men to ask for that. It was basically assumed. It was very customary. But Nabal rejected the men. And to make matters worse, he sent them away with this stinging insult, verse 10, who is David? Who is this runt son of Jesse? You know, there are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Who is David? Everybody knows, he knows who David is. Not only is he not showing gratitude, he is deliberately taking a shot at David. David's just another runaway slave. Imagine you are a waiter at a really nice restaurant. And some huge party comes in. They rent a private room, and you and a couple of runners are assigned responsibility for that room. They're your only assignment for the night. They're there for like 5 hours until after midnight, an hour and a half after closing time. You stay the whole time, and you and your team give them excellent service. You really bust your hump to make sure that you take care of their needs. Well, the bill comes. It's for several $1,000s. And the guy disputes a couple of small items on the receipt and then leaves no tip. So you go out to the car where he's, and you're like, hey, sir, I think you forgot to fill out the tip portion. And he says, quit begging me for money, you mouth breather. The only reason you're a waiter is probably because you flunked out of school and you couldn't handle a real job. Get out of my face. Now, I'm guessing if that's you, you're gonna be angry on multiple levels. Well, see, that's basically what happened to David, just on a much larger scale. Right, it's not just David, it's David and all of his men. It's over a year's salary, not just an evening's. Plus, Nabal's insult, I think, touched on a tender spot for David. I mean, after all, David had grown up as the runt, right? I mean, for crying out loud, when Samuel came to choose one of Jesse's sons as king, David's dad forgot about him. Literally did not even invite him to the tryout. That's not a wound you recover from easily. For David's whole life, he's felt overlooked. And now Saul has publicly smeared him and exiled him. He's told everybody that David is a traitor and an opportunist. So Nabal's insult plays on those insecurities. And so verse 13, David says, that's it. That's it. Every man strap on his sword. It's go time. Verse 21, Nabal has returned me evil for good. God help me if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him. David's gonna go out for vengeance against this nobody. Hey, y'all, where's this guy? Where's that guy from 1 Samuel 24 who said, I'm not gonna take vengeance into my own hands. I'm gonna let God handle these things. David had been bravely faithful in a cave. Now he just caves. Last week, David resisted killing Saul when Saul, who had been actively seeking his life, was sitting there right in front of him. This week, he's about to murder a bunch of innocent people because he got stiffed on a tip and insulted by a nobody. That guy who resisted killing his enemy is about to murder a whole household of a nobody. He passed the big test, and he's about to fail the little one. By the way, does that ever happen to you? You resist some big temptation only to fall to a much smaller one? I don't know what it is, but that happens. That has happened to me several times throughout my life. When I stumble and fall, it's almost always after some big spiritual victory. And then I fall prey to the smallest of temptations. David is tired. He is worn out. And this guy is playing on his deepest insecurities, so David loses it. Well, Nabal has a wife named Abigail. And you remember verse 3, she is described as discerning and beautiful. She hears about this, verse 18. Then she made haste and she pulled together a big gift basket full of fruit and meat kebabs, some Fig Newtons, a couple of Starbucks gift cards, and a pair of AirPods. At least that's how my verse 18 reads. And she rushes out to meet David. Verse 24, she approaches David, she bows down to the earth and she says, on me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. You see, Nabal's name means fool in Hebrew, which means it either originated from another language or was a nickname that his buddies gave him, because I'm just having a real hard time seeing any parent knowingly naming their kid fool. I mean, I've heard some crazy naming stories. One lady who delivered a set of twins recently, one came out just before midnight, one came out just after midnight, and the mother named them Today and Tamara. Again, that's cute, but like she gotta grow up with that. Or I heard about a guy in Texas whose last name was Hogg, H-O-G-G, Hogg. He had twin girls and he named one Ima and the other Yura. Ima Hogg and Yura Hogg. Now, that's funny for him, but where is the mom in that situation? You have to ask that, right? So I've heard some crazy, what were those parents thinking, naming stories. But I just cannot imagine any parent ever intentionally calling their kid fool from birth. So Nabal is either from another language or it's a nickname. Either way, that's what he goes by. She continues, Nabal, fool is his name and folly is with him. He's named stupid, he is stupid. Ladies, I will say, this is not exactly a model for how you should talk about your husband, but when there's a band of soldiers coming to kill all the males in your household, you do what you gotta do, right? Watch this. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. I love this. David, this would not have happened if I had been involved. Next time you come, ask to speak to the lady of the house, please, okay? Now listen to what she says next. David, you know that if men rise up to pursue you, and to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be in the care of the Lord your God, and the lives of your enemies, he's gonna sling out as the hollow of a sling. What is she doing? She is reminding David of the promises of God, who he is in the Lord and what God has promised to do for him. Do you see how she brought up the word sling twice in that statement? What is she trying to do there? She's very subtly and artfully reminding David, hey, David, remember how God took out Goliath for you? Remember how he did it with just a sling? God is the one that fights your battles, David. You don't need to take matters into your own hands. God fights for you. Verse 30, and when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has promised him, and he has made you prince over Israel when you become king, then my Lord shall have no cause of grief and no pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause or for my Lord taking vengeance himself. One day she says, when you come to the throne, you're gonna have to tell the story of how you got there. And on that day, David, when you're retelling for your grandkids the story of how God put you on the throne, do you really want to have to mention a chapter like this where you got insulted by a nobody and killed a bunch of innocent people in response? By the way, could I pause there? That is actually great counsel. One day your life is gonna be told as a story to the next generation. If you're a parent, it's gonna be to your kids and grandkids. Are you living in a way now that you're gonna be proud then of how it's told? Mom and dad, they just couldn't wait to be married and do things God's way, so they lived together for a couple of years like everybody else in their culture. Is that what you want your kids and grandkids to say? Or do you want them to say, Mom and Dad were determined to do things God's way, and they put Christ at the center of our home from the very beginning? Or how about this? Mom and Dad always lived right on the edge of their spending abilities. They didn't really tithe or save because they just wanted to enjoy things in the moment. They always wanted the best clothes. They wanted the best cars. They wanted the best vacations right then. Is that what you want them to say? Or would you want them to say, Mom and Dad determined to put God first in their finances and to live generously always. We trusted God even when it was hard, and they taught me by their example that I could trust God too. I saw them live out trust and generosity. Or how about when he was single? He was frantic and desperate, always running around everywhere, couldn't just wait to figure out what was going on. Or do you want him to say he learned to trust God and wait on God no matter the circumstances? You see, faith means living today in a way that one day you'll be glad you did. Faith means thinking about how you want the story of your life to be told to the next generation and then living that way now. And that's what she says to him. One day this is gonna be a story. You need to make sure it's told in the right way, David. You don't want this chapter as a part of it. David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you. That's a key word. He sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from avenging myself with my own hand. Here's our first lesson. Number one, we need the body of Christ. I don't care if you're David or not. Everybody has lapses of judgment. David in the previous chapter is the one urging everybody else to stand firm. Now David is the one who caves. That's why we all need Abigails in our lives, even if you think you're a David. In verse 32, David recognizes God sent you to me. God sent you to warn me and keep me from danger. You have got to be in a place where God can send those people to you also, because everybody has lapses of judgment, even if you're a giant killer like David. Everybody gets caught in a weak moment when the right combination of factors expose a vulnerability. Abigail is that friend in your small group who speaks up when you're about to make a bad decision. Y'all, I've told you this before, and I'm not violating confidentiality, but people in our church sometimes will tell me about the dumbest decisions that they have made. And I'm trying to keep a straight face when they're telling me, and I ask them, why on earth did you think that was a good idea? And they say, well, I mean, I prayed about it, and it just felt right. Y'all, please do not misunderstand what I'm about to say. But God has given you something even more reliable than prayer. And that is the counsel of the body of Christ. That is how God answers your prayers for wisdom. In a multitude of counselors, he says, there is wisdom. So you're praying about something God's already given you an answer for. When people make one of these colossally bad decisions, it usually happens, by the way, on the throes of an emotion. They were angry, or they were excited about the possibilities of the new romance, and they were love struck. Or they got starry-eyed over what it would be like to drive that new car or go on that vacation or wear those kind of clothes. And they were all swept up in the emotion, and you needed somebody wise who was detached from that emotion to tell you what the best thing to do was. An isolated man, we saw this, seeks his own desire, and he rages against all sound judgment. You need Abigails in your life. And by the way, you should pray to be an Abigail to others. Abigail is a model of godly counsel in every way. I mean, look at it. She speaks with calm clarity in an emotionally charged situation. Even with so much personally on the line, she is as cool as a kosher cucumber. She does not freak out. She comes humbly. She bows down. She shows honor. She doesn't come haughtily or filled with rage or self-righteousness. She comes kindly, bringing food and warmth, but she speaks boldly and honestly. She doesn't mince words. Best of all, she grounds her counsel in who God is and the promises that he's made to David. God, give us friends like Abigail. Amen? By the way, I just sensed in prepping this message that there is some, I'm gonna say woman here, that you need to play this role of Abigail in somebody else's life right now. And there is a specific situation that you need to speak into somebody's life, because like Abigail, you're gonna save their life. And by the way, I love how the story rather subtly challenges our stereotypes, doesn't it? Nabal is the weak, emotional one, and Abigail is the calm, courageous one. Our society often assumes the opposite, doesn't it? Women are the irrational, emotional ones, and men are the calm, strong ones. In this story, both David and Nabal are the ones consumed by their emotions, and it is only Abigail who keeps her head. Ladies, God made you to be an Abigail. some of the best chapters of human history, for sure some of the most important chapters in the history of the church have been written by strong, wise, courageous women. Women who saved the day when the men around them were acting like fools. And as a dad of three young daughters, I want to raise Abigails, not doormats. Which leads me to our second conclusion, our second lesson. This one, by the way, is an exclusive for you ladies. Number two, ladies, you can be a wise woman and a blessing to your family, even with a foolish husband. Somebody needs to hear it, okay? See, I say that because sometimes a woman ends up in a marriage that is, shall we say, not ideal. Maybe she got married too young. Maybe she got married before she was a Christian. Maybe the guy just changed, but whatever. Bottom line is, she's married to a guy who is not leading his life as a spiritual leader. And so now she feels trapped. She feels like she's never gonna be able to make a positive impact on the world. She's never gonna be able to make a positive impact on her family. Every week, listening to me, I'm guessing there are hundreds of you women in that category. Learn from Abigail. Abigail saves the life of her husband and her children despite her bad marriage. Some of you are in difficult marriages, and I don't wanna sugarcoat it, okay? I know it's hard, but God has you there for a reason. You can probably see how God has already used that difficult marriage to teach you more about him, right? Sometimes the best insights about God, usually the best insights about God, come through pain and difficulty, right? It's like Socrates, who was not a Christian. It's like he always said, by all means, marry. If you get a good spouse, you'll be happy. If you get a bad one, you'll become a philosopher, right? Or we might say a theologian. I've heard it described similar to how a pearl is formed in an oyster. That beautiful, priceless pearl starts out in the heart of the oyster as an irritant. It's a grain of sand. The oyster covers over that irritant with the pearl coating, and through years and years of living with that irritant, something incredibly valuable is formed. No irritant, no pearl. For some of you, that difficult relationship is the irritant that forms the pearl of God's character in you. Which means you can go home today and start calling your husband your little pearl. It'll be kind of an inside joke, okay? I'm just kidding, don't say that. But I will say that God is using this marriage to produce beauty in you, and this is important too, just as he did with Abigail, God has you there to save the lives of others in your family. 1 Corinthians 7, Paul said that a believing mom in an unbelieving family sanctifies her kids. Sanctify means to set apart. Paul is saying that her presence, that presence of that believing mom in that home, sets apart her kids for grace. It gives them a chance to see the gospel lived out and to believe. There's a guy on our staff team who told me that the only Christian in his family, the only one he knew of, was the grandmother. His parents weren't Christians. None of the grandfathers were Christians. None of his aunts, uncles, or anybody else in the entire family followed Jesus, just her. He said she faithfully stayed in an environment where she was lonely, often ridiculed, where she always went to church all by herself. He said, but one by one through the years, I watched as every single one of us grandkids got saved. Now he said, all of us grandchildren were all believers, all because of a grandmother who stayed in a difficult situation where she felt alone. I'm just saying that might be you. God might even use you to save the life of your husband. 1 Corinthians 7, the Apostle Paul talks about an unbelieving man who is woken up because of the consistency, the wisdom, and the patient, faithful beauty of his wife. They see how you react to hardship and it opens up their heart to the gospel. You know, my point is simply this. Who knows what God is gonna do with your faithfulness? Don't abandon your post. Learn from Abigail. Even if you're married to a fool, God can still use you as a tool, okay? I was proud of that one. I got a corresponding point for you men. Number three, men, don't be a Nabal. I mean, this is pretty straightforward. I don't even have a lot to say about it, but what a terrible story to be told about your life. Don't make your wife have to go behind your back to accomplish these things. Don't make her go behind your back to get your kids in church. Don't make her go behind your back to honor God with your finances. She's always trying to sneak a gift in. Don't make her be the one that's always trying to discipline the kids and get them to come to small group and get them up in the morning, get them dressed for church. Don't make her do that because you're pursuing a life of foolishness. You need to lead in such a way that her wisdom complements yours. So men, are you the spiritual leader in your family? Are you the leader in generosity? Are you the one that's saying we need to sacrifice here? We need to make this a priority. We need to do this. Are you leading in discipline? Some of you men need to wake up out of your Nabal ways. In fact, maybe you're here this morning and your wife has been inviting you to church, pleading with you to come, and now you're here. Friend, that's not accidental. You may not have it all figured out yet, but the journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step, and it's time for you today to take that step. Let me show you how the story ends, verse 36. And Abigail returns home, and came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house. It was like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. Crunk, the kids would say. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. And the morning when the wine had gone out of Nabal. Now, I have to point this out. It's just too good to pass up. This chapter is filled with Hebrew plays on words that we miss in English. Scholars say this is all very obvious in Hebrew. Nabal is not only the word for fool, it also sounds like the Hebrew word for wineskin, Nabal. And get this, that next phrase, when the wine had gone out of him, that was a Hebrew euphemism for peeing. And this chapter, by the way, is filled with references to peeing. I don't know any other way to say that. I'm only pointing out one, there's like three of them in there. If you look at my transcript, I've got them in the footnotes. The author is saying, Nabal is nothing more than an insignificant wineskin peeing away his life. When the wine is gone, there ain't nothing left of him. I need you to put all this together. In chapter 24, the author made poop jokes. In chapter 25, he makes pee jokes. I'm not kidding, okay? Look at my transcript. They're obvious in Hebrew. So middle school boys, I want you to hear me very clearly. Tell your parents later that I said, if you like to make potty jokes, you're in good company, okay, huh? See what I did there? All right, back to the text. When the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him those things and his heart died within him. He became like a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. Now, that's tragic for Nabal, of course, but the author is trying to show us just like Abigail said, God is gonna fight David's battles for him. If David will just leave things in God's hand, David doesn't need to take vengeance on fools like Nabal. God will do it. And that leads us to the fourth lesson. You cannot accomplish the promise of the Spirit and the power of the flesh. That was the theme. This is the theme that ties this story to chapter 24. It's what makes it part two. Only that in this chapter, David almost goes back on the lesson he demonstrated for us so beautifully in the previous chapter. When life takes an unexpected turn, you gotta make a choice. You can take matters into your own hands, or you can do things God's way and wait on him to fulfill his promises. And maybe the primary way that you and I are tempted to take matters back into our own hands is when we face that temptation to exact vengeance on our enemies. It's like I told you last week, when you are wronged, when somebody insults you, somebody mistreats you, somebody does something unjust to you, it's like a little tuning fork gets rung inside of you that feels like it's in complete harmony with the universe. And y'all, when you're getting back at somebody, it doesn't feel wrong, does it? It feels right. Oh, it feels right. You feel nigh unto deity. When you are telling that person off, when you're sticking it to them, you feel like, yes, this is right. When somebody cuts you off in traffic, when somebody is rude to you in traffic, pulls into your lane and runs up on your bumper and then has the audacity to somehow act like it is your fault, then lay on the horn and then zoom by you giving you the one finger salute. And you're like, this is an oddly specific example. Yes. Do you just instinctively roll down the window and yell, bless you, friend? No. Your instinct is to speed up and to respond with unkindness to their unkindness. That's our instinct. And momentary traffic episodes might not be that big of a deal, but that same instinct works its way out in almost every relationship we have, whether it's with our spouse, our friends, people in a small group, our employer. We think to restore righteousness, we need to take matters into our own hands. So your friend is self-absorbed and they are insensitive to your needs. So you respond by being aloof and distant. Your boss is a jerk. So you respond with sloppy work or by finding ways to undermine him or her. Your spouse is rude and they're insensitive to you. So you're cold and petty toward them. Some family member lets you down or makes you mad. So you blow up and scream at them. You realize all of those responses are you trying to fix a situation by the power of your flesh. We think that by repaying unkindness with unkindness, we can fix that person because hopefully we think when that other person gets a taste of my anger and they understand how they've hurt me, that will make them change their ways. Feels so right, doesn't it? Makes so much sense. Only problem is, have you noticed, are you old enough to know that it never really works? Y'all listen carefully to this verse from James in the New Testament. The wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Therefore, put away all filthiness and rampant wickedness and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. The anger of men cannot produce the righteousness of God. The anger of men cannot build God's kingdom or advance it in somebody's life. It feels like when you see a lack of righteousness in your spouse or in your kids or in your boss or your friends, it feels like if you get angry and you punish them for what they did, that will wake them up into righteousness. Isn't that what you think? But James very clearly says here, nope, the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God in somebody else. It just produces unrighteousness in you. There's something else that produces righteousness in people. What is it? He tells you. The implanted word sown in grace, that's what produces righteousness. So he says, put away all filthiness and rampant wickedness because out of the wicked comes wickedness and respond instead with meekness and forgiveness and grace because that is how God's righteousness is produced in the world. That's how God's righteousness is produced in somebody else. Think about it. That's how Jesus produced righteousness in you, right? Jesus did not produce righteousness in you by paying you back for your sin. He produced righteousness in you by showing you grace. God's law told me what I was supposed to do. His threats of judgment may have scared me into some outward conformity to those commands, but only God's grace gave me the desire to obey him. Only grace produced real righteousness in me. You will never accomplish the work of the Spirit in somebody else's life by the power of the flesh. This was a big theme in Paul's letters too. Paul says, Romans 12, don't be conquered by evil. Conquer evil with good. You want to conquer evil around you? You want to conquer evil in your boss? You want to conquer evil in your spouse that is irritating you? You want to conquer evil in your kids or in your friends? That word conquered is a military term in Greek. How do you conquer evil in others? You don't do it by repaying evil with evil, which feels instinctive. You do it by repaying evil with good and by trusting God and letting the Spirit work. Taking matters into your own hands doesn't truly conquer evil in them or in you. It just makes a mess for everybody, right? Many of you know Rick Langston. He's one of our oldest pastors on staff here at Summit Church. Predates me here. He's in his 60s now. He and his wife, Judy, have a great marriage, exemplary marriage. They recently celebrated 41 years of marriage. One day, Rick told me, I said to her recently, I was like, hey, you know, for these last 41 years, I have not been a perfect spouse. Over those years, I've often been selfish and rude. Sometimes I've blown up at you over the smallest things, but Judy, every time I do, you just stay so calm. And y'all, it's true, if you know her, she stays so calm always. Rick was like, how do you do that? How do you maintain that calmness? And she said, oh, it's easy. Whenever you blow up at me, I just go and clean the bathroom. I scrub the toilet and it just takes my anger away. And Rick was like, that helps? She said, yeah, because I always use your toothbrush to scrub the toilet. That is not really true. I just made that story up. But here's another one that is true. Winston Churchill had a long-standing feud with a lady of the English nobility named Lady Astor. Their long-standing acrimony was so bad. This is not a joke. It's attested to by multiple people, multiple sources, that people knew never to invite the two of them to the same dinner party because for sure, like vinegar and baking soda, some blow up would happen. Well, sure enough, some noob to London invites them both. And over dinner at the table, Churchill and this lady get into this ferocious argument. And Lady Astor shouted at him across the table, if I were your wife, Winston, I would poison your coffee. To which Churchill replied, "And if I were your husband, I would drink it." Right? Once, again, these are all validated. So once Lady Astor was throwing a costume ball and she had to invite Winston Churchill because he was the prime minister. But she didn't want to invite him. And so she begrudgingly sent him an invitation. And when Churchill accepted the invitation, he sent back his RSVP, asking her what costume he might wear so that nobody would recognize him because he did not want to be seen at her house. She responded that if he came sober, nobody would recognize him. When he went to the party, they say they got an RSVP. At one point, she noticed him with like a martini in his hand or something, and she yelled, "Winston, you're drunk." To which he replied, and I kid you not, he said, "Yes, but you are ugly. And in the morning, I shall be sober." That was his response. Now, amazing responses, world-class wit, right? But you know this, their relationship never got better. She was never like, "You know what? I'm changing. That's a good one." Tit for tat just deepened the divide. Repaying evil with evil never stops evil. It just multiplies it. If you want to be a vehicle of God's power, if you want to produce true righteousness in the hearts of the people that you love, and you want to produce true righteousness in the world, then you're going to leave vengeance to God and respond with grace instead. Because again, y'all, isn't that how Jesus changed us? Which brings me to the last point, maybe the most important point of this story. Number five, is David really the king that we're looking for? Is David really the king that we're looking for? In some ways, y'all, I wish this story ended with David relenting of his desire to take vengeance on Nabal. Because you might be able just to forgive that as a temporary lapse, but the author then tucks in a subtle little detail that portends much worse things to come. Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take Abigail as his wife. Verse 42, and Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her five young women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. Now, at first, that sounds great, right? Storybook ending. Abigail's an amazing woman, a good catch for sure, but see, that began for David the multiplication of wives. You see the next verse, verse 43, David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. That's now wives number two and number three for David. David unfortunately begins to follow the custom of his day to exploit his position as king to take lots of wives. But see, in Deuteronomy 17, God had explicitly warned future Israelite kings not to do this. This chapter, 1 Samuel 25, you probably rewrite over and don't even realize what's happening. But 1 Samuel 25 is one of the first indications that David may not be the promised king that we've been looking for, hoping for, waiting for. You see, up until this point, he seemed like he was. David was the humble shepherd boy who trusted God and lived with undaunted courage. David, up until now, has carried himself with grace and trusted God in impossible circumstances. But here we see in this chapter, first, we see a lapse in faith where David succumbs to a vengeful spirit. And second, we see him start to leverage his kingly privilege to multiply wives in direct disobedience to a command of God. Y'all, we're just a few chapters into David's story, and already our hearts are beginning to yearn for a king more righteous than David. The whole point is that our salvation is never gonna come from man, no matter how strong or how righteous they appear, for all have sinned, and all, including David and Abigail and Billy Graham and Mother Teresa and me and you and your grandma and your parents, all of us have sinned, and all of us have fallen short of the glory of God. There is none righteous, not even one. Even David will fail us. Your dad will fail you. Your spouse will fail you. I will fail you. In fact, the irony is, in this story, David is not the picture of Jesus in this story. Abigail is. I mean, think about it. Abigail is a wise, discerning sage who rides in on a donkey, humbles herself, then takes the blame for everything that's happened on herself, even though she was innocent. Then she offered to David a meal of peace, which happened to be, by the way, a meal of lamb. And by her bravery and her sacrifice, purchases salvation for everybody in her household. David's not the best picture of Jesus in this story. She is. And we're starting to see that David may not be the hoped-for king who's gonna give us identity, security, and happiness. No, those things are gonna have to come through a later king, a descendant of David, who's gonna lay down his life for all of us treasonous Nabals. By the way, if you're looking for you in this story, like, oh, where's the example that I can follow here? Who am I in this story? You're Nabal. We're all strutting around like kings, ungrateful to God for his kindness, despising and rebuffing his goodness. And Jesus, the true king, like Abigail, comes riding in on a donkey to save us from the wrath that we deserve, taking vengeance on himself, dying for us instead. The true king, the king that you and I are searching for is not David. It's gonna be the son of David, but not just the son of David. He's also gonna be the son of God. And unlike David, that son of God is never gonna falter or fail. He's never gonna need to be reminded to trust God. He is never gonna leverage his position to abuse us and abuse us for himself. He's gonna become the hope, not just of Israel. He's gonna become the hope of all the nations. And whether you know it or not, he's the king you're searching for also. He's the hope of your heart. Why don't you bow your heads if you would? Bow your heads similar to last week. Let me ask you again, where are you trying to accomplish God's purposes by the power of your flesh? Where have you taken matters back into your own hands? Where are you about to become your own Benedict Arnold? Where do you need right now just to lay it down and to trust God and say, God, I'm not gonna take vengeance. I'm not gonna try to fix this person. I'm not gonna try to promote myself. I'm just gonna rest in you and wait on you to fulfill this promise. As you ponder that there with the Holy Spirit, let me ask a second question for a different group of you. Have you submitted to King Jesus? Have you submitted to King Jesus? Because y'all, that's the big point of all these stories. Jesus is the true king that God gave. The king that will at last give you what you've been hoping for, who gives you grace instead of judgment if you will surrender to him and receive that offer to save you. If you've never done that, then right now where you sit, you can just say, Lord Jesus, you're the king. Right now, I surrender to you. Right now, I receive your offer to save me. Say it to him from your heart where you sit. Right now, I surrender to you. You're the king. I receive your offer to save me. Father, I pray for those that right now just began that relationship with Jesus. I pray that this would become a life-defining moment for them. Let them follow through with that and take the next steps. Father, I pray that we would be a church full of people who wait on you and do not try to accomplish in our children, our spouses, our bosses, our neighbors by the power of the flesh, which you can only do in the Spirit. May we be a people who waits on you to do what only you can do. We pray in Jesus' name.